the most common critical care procedure we perform.
We're basically embarking on a physiologic journey that's about to change relatively quickly.
These are complex patients.
We have to know how to change it.
A very important and pragmatic clinical question.
We need to optimize our patient's physiology.
Of course it's not going to show any benefit.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. I hope this podcast finds you all doing well. We are certainly coming up on holiday time here in the United States, coming up on the Thanksgiving holiday. Hoping that all of you have some wonderful plans to get together with some family and friends over the course of the latter half of November. Let me bring in my outstanding co-host here on this podcast. We've got Dr. Rob Rodriguez and Dr. John Greenwood. Rob, how are you doing this podcast?
Doing very well, other than in California, this is fire season. We've had a number of fires affecting both Southern and Northern California. And to complicate things, we've had preemptive power outages. My power outage lasted 5 days, so other than that, doing pretty well, though.
The lights are back on and the power is restored, huh?
It was actually interesting because not only did we lose power, but in my area had no cell phone coverage. So you were kind of on your own, basically, if something came up.
We are just on the heels of the ASAP 2019 Scientific Assembly, and I was there during the latter half of the Scientific Assembly in Denver, and I know that several speakers from the Southern California area actually had to depart early because of those fires and actually threatening their homes. So I certainly hope they all made out okay, but it's quite dangerous out there.
It is a difficult kind of year, and it seems to become the new norm, I suppose, for California now, for late fall and early winter to have these fires.
Well, we certainly wish all of our colleagues and friends the best out in this difficult time. John, I think things perhaps may be environmentally a little bit better north of Baltimore and Philly. How are things going for you?
Go well. Yeah, we don't have as much of austere conditions up here in Philadelphia. The most dangerous things I'm worried about now are the sports fans and how our sports teams are playing. But things are going well. Things are calming down in the department, in the hospital a little bit before flu season as the trauma volume goes down a little bit as the temperature gets a little bit cooler. But definitely wishing you well, Rob, out there and hoping that everything kind of gets back to normal soon.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
Well, let's shift over to our podcast topic this month. We've talked a lot about sepsis and the fact that that's the most common critical illness we resuscitate in the emergency department and in the intensive care unit. Let's switch to a procedure, and that is endotracheal intubation, more so rapid sequence intubation. It is the most common critical care procedure we perform in the emergency department and most often in the intensive care unit. And I think all of us can probably raise our hands, acknowledge that at some point when performing an RSI, we have had patients sustain cardiovascular collapse, whether that be peri-intubation hypotension or peri-intubation cardiac arrest. Now, during our literature update in 2018, we reviewed an article that was out of Critical Care Medicine that took a look at many studies. It was a systematic analysis to essentially determine how frequently is peri-intubation cardiac arrest, and more importantly, what were the risk factors that predicted peri-intubation cardiac arrest. And no surprise, that systematic review, consistent with the literature, how often peri-intubation cardiovascular arrest or cardiac arrest occurs, and that's somewhere about 3-5%. And the five risk factors that this particular paper highlighted were hypotension prior to intubation, hypoxemia prior to intubation, the absence of adequate pre-oxygenation, obesity, and then patients that we intubate from an RSI standpoint over the age of 75. And those first three, hypotension, hypoxemia, and the absence of pre-oxygenation, really speak to our efforts to maximize someone's pre-intubation physiology as best we can before undergoing RSI. And for this particular podcast, we're going to focus on one component, and that is hypotension prior to intubation. Now, this is based on an article that is EPUB ahead of print, so not out just yet, but published online, Lancet Respiratory Medicine. The lead author is Dr. Jans, and it is titled The Effect of a Fluid Bolus on Cardiovascular Collapse Among Critically Ill Adults Undergoing Tracheal Intubation. This was deemed the PREPARE trial, and it was a randomized controlled trial, as I said, just published online in Lancet Respiratory Medicine. Now, the authors go through a lot of background that we just mentioned, and they cite that as many as 1 in 4 critically ill patients undergoing endotracheal intubation may sustain cardiovascular collapse, and that may include shock, cardiac arrest, or the worst outcome, patient death. And the possible mechanisms they dive into in the article, they talk about, are patients, or could they be hypovolemic? Do they have impaired systemic vascular resistance? Perhaps in some cases, it's our administration of sedative medications. And then in some patients, it's the marked reduction in venous return when we institute positive pressure ventilation. Absolutely, study after study continues to show that patients who sustain peri-intubation cardiovascular collapse do have increased in hospital mortality. And when we focus and drill down on patients who are preventing hypotension in the pre-intubation and during intubation setting, most of us, and we've recommended this on the podcast before, administering IV fluids either before or during the course of rapid sequence intubation in an attempt to prevent patients from sustaining a cardiovascular collapse. Having said that, we talk about it a lot, but there's actually no randomized controlled trials that have looked at the utilization of IV fluids on the outcomes of patients undergoing rapid sequence intubation and endotracheal intubation. So that brings us to this current trial, the PREPARE trial. The authors, in essence, set out to assess whether the administration of a fluid bolus reduces the incidence of cardiovascular collapse when compared with no IV fluid bolus during endotracheal intubation, a very important and pragmatic clinical question on something that we encounter very frequently. So, Rob, I'm going to turn to you. Tell us about the PREPARE trial.
Yeah, Mike. So this was a pragmatic, multi-center, unblinded, randomized trial that occurred at 8 ICUs and 1 ED. I want to give a shout out to our colleagues at LSU, Vanderbilt, University of Alabama, Burlington, Massachusetts, University of Washington, and Lincoln Medical Center in New York. And this trial included adults greater than 18 years of age who were undergoing endotracheal intubation, and they excluded patients if awake intubation was planned, if the intubation was immediately needed, in other words, like a crash type intubation. They also excluded patients if the treating clinician felt IV fluids were required or contraindicated for optimal care. And then patients may have also been co-enrolled in the PREVENT trial or the bag mask valve ventilation during tracheal intubation trial. So they randomized 1-to-1 these patients, and the intervention was a fluid bolus. In the intervention group, the treating team would administer 500 cc's of crystalloid before induction and continue the infusion throughout induction and laryngoscopy. In the group that was randomized to no fluid bolus, the study protocol recommended against giving crystalloid infusions between enrollment and 2 minutes after completion of endotracheal intubation. So in other words, this is a very sort of immediate pre-intubation kind of thing. So of note, intravenous fluid that was initiated as part of clinical care before enrollment continued in both study groups if that was thought to be needed. And from a pragmatic standpoint, all other aspects of the intubation were at the discretion of the treating teams. And so in terms of their primary outcome, it was a composite primary outcome consisting of systolic blood pressure, a new drop to less than 65 during or within 2 minutes after intubation, new or increased vasopressor use during or within 2 minutes after intubation, cardiac arrest within an hour of intubation, or death within an hour of intubation. So any of those four would qualify as part of the composite outcome. Again, systolic blood pressure drop below 65, new drop below 65 during or within 2 minutes of intubation, new need for vasopressor during or within 2 minutes of intubation, cardiac arrest or death within an hour of intubation. They had a number of secondary outcomes that included any additional IV fluids given to either group between induction and 2 minutes after intubation, lowest systolic blood pressure between induction and 2 minutes after intubation, change in systolic blood pressure from induction to lowest systolic blood pressure, number of laryngoscopy attempts, number of ventilator-free days, number of ICU-free days, and then finally, in-hospital mortality over a 28-day follow-up period. In terms of their primary analysis, they conducted an unadjusted intention-to-treat comparison for this outcome. So, John, how about taking us through the results of this trial?
Sure, Rob. Yeah, that was a great summary there. So it appears that the trial in total screened 537 critically ill adults who were intubated at these 9 sites during this enrollment period. 511 inclusion criteria, and they ended up enrolling and randomizing about 60% or a little over 300 patients in this trial. So of the fluid group, so about half of that, which was 168 patients, 98%, so nearly all of them, received the full 500 milliliter bolus. The median volume of fluid infused before induction with RSI meds was 200 mils, so a fairly small amount. The no fluid group, again, it was about 169 patients, so same size, 99% didn't receive any fluid bolus at all. After randomization, procedural characteristics really didn't differ between the two groups. So as they're going through the trial, they reviewed by the Data Safety Monitoring Board, and they determined that there was no need to go on further for futility and stop the trial early. So primary outcomes, what they found, the composite of particularly cardiovascular collapse, the fluid group had 20%. And the no fluid group had 18%. So that was a p-value of 0.76. So it was fairly insignificant. And the incidence of each component of the composite outcome did not differ significantly between the two groups. And then if we take a look at those secondary outcomes, Rob, that you mentioned, looking particularly at some clinical factors as well as length of stay factors, there was no significant difference between the two groups. So no difference for the primary outcome, which is cardiovascular collapse composite, and no difference between fluid bolus and non-fluid bolus for the other clinical secondary outcomes, as well as length of stay outcomes. Now, for patients receiving positive pressure ventilation, that's either non-invasive bag valve mask, fluid bolus administration appeared to decrease the incidence of what was defined as cardiovascular collapse. For patients not receiving positive pressure ventilation leading into intubation, the fluid bolus appeared to increase the incidence of cardiovascular collapse. I don't really know what to make of that. I think at the end, this was a fairly neutral or negative study for lots of reasons. But Mike, I think there are some limitations to this trial. Maybe you could talk about those.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a great job, Rob, taking us through the study, John, taking us through the study results. I think that any study that we talk about here, we try to get you the groundbreaking, hot off the press studies. And as with every study, there are limitations. And I think the primary one here in the PREPARE trial is that it was stopped early, so it didn't reach the number of patients that they had hoped to recruit, stopped for futility. This was primarily in the ICU, so they did have one emergency department of the 9 sites, but it was primarily in ICU critically ill patients. And I think we can all kind of acknowledge when Rob was going through the study design, the administration of 500 mLs, perhaps that just wasn't enough fluid. Maybe it was inadequate amount of fluid to perhaps affect cardiovascular collapse. And overall, the timing of that fluid bolus. So they would start it with induction and then infuse it during the RSI procedure. We don't know if the results would have been different, perhaps if IV fluids had been started earlier. But it's definitely one of those trials that is currently being talked about in social media settings across numerous sites. The fact that this trial, as it was designed, and the 500 cc fluid bolus starting from induction through the endotracheal intubation actually didn't affect or reduce the incidence of cardiovascular collapse when compared to those patients that weren't given fluid going into intubation. So some very surprising and interesting results. I think circling back to what we started off this podcast with, we definitely know hypotension prior to intubation is one of those risk factors that is definitely and strongly associated with peri-intubation hypotension and cardiovascular collapse. So, John, I'm going to turn back to you, and then you can maybe throw it over to Rob. Thinking about this study, does it really state that we shouldn't be given fluids? Perhaps we should give fluids earlier? Does it mean we should go to vasopressors sooner? When you've got a patient who's at risk and you're thinking this is high risk for peri-intubation cardiovascular collapse secondary to hypotension, what are some of the things that you're thinking about and perhaps doing at the bedside for your patients?
So that's a great question, Mike. And, you know, I think that this trial falls into the pattern of, unfortunately, a lot of critical care trials these days, which are taking a very large heterogeneous patient population, lumping in a single intervention and seeing if it improves an outcome like mortality, when we all know that critically ill patients are really complex. And as we're endeavoring on RSI and intubation, we're basically embarking on a physiologic journey that's about to change relatively quickly. And I think you started off this podcast very nicely saying that we need to optimize our patient's physiology. And because it's so variable, this is really important. And it is an important question because we do know that a high shock index, for example, being your heart rate divided by your systolic blood pressure, is a modifiable risk factor for patient morbidity, particularly peri-intubation hypotension. So it's something that we can change, but we have to know how to change it. And so for me, as I'm preparing to optimize my patient leading into this procedure, I still use a lot of ultrasound. And so if this patient's really sick, I'm doing a quick focused echo looking at the left ventricular function, right ventricular function, and volume status to determine whether or not I need to initiate or have ready a vasopressor or an inotrope in the case of poor systolic function, or if they're hypovolemic and they would benefit from either blood or some sort of volume expander or crystalloid. So I think that for me, how I'm approaching these really sick patients who I'm about to intubate, I want to know more about them. It's not just a broad strokes. I don't look to the nurse and say, hang a bag of fluid. I want to know what's wrong with them and their cardiovascular physiology so I can be prepared to intervene or intervene ideally prior to giving them medications that cause vasoplegia and reduction in your vascular resistance. And that was one question that I kind of had, and it wasn't stated in the article, and maybe it was in the supplementary material, but it didn't appear that they controlled for RSI medications or dosages, which, as we all know, is really important as we're deciding on how we're going to intubate our patients.
Some great thoughts. Rob, give us your thoughts.
Yeah, I think John's spot on in terms of this actual trial. This is, again, sort of analogous to these big ICU trials in which we're trying a specific agent for sepsis or something else like that. These are complex patients, and to apply a one-size-fits-all intervention broadly to such a heterogeneous group, of course it's not going to show any benefit. I think this trial doesn't really change my practice. I'm with John in terms of tailoring your pre-induction therapies, just as we have to tailor our other regimens, our other interventions to specific patients. I'm looking at, is this an older person? Do they have signs of hypovolemia? And I think that you really have to use a tailored approach to these patients. And this trial is not going to stop me from giving bolus fluids to patients who I think may be challenged in that regard.
You guys have brought out some really outstanding points. My thanks. I would add to that in terms of those risk factors that we highlighted from the 2018 Critical Care Medicine article. We know it's a risk factor when you're encountering that patient who has marginal hemodynamics or hypoxemia. Just understand that they're at extremely high risk of peri-intubation, cardiac arrest, or cardiovascular collapse, and really trying to do everything you can individually for that patient, individualized therapy to maximize their physiology. And while perhaps this trial was negative in the sense that the administration of at least 500 cc's of crystalloid wasn't beneficial, be thinking about concurrent or concomitant vasopressor use. Now, just as a little bit of a teaser, In upcoming podcasts, we're going to be finishing out 2019 here. We're going to be doing our literature update, and I suspect that will highlight two articles that came out in 2019 on the utilization of push-dose pressors. So more to come on that. We'll review those studies in an upcoming podcast at our year end. Having said that, be thinking about early institution of vasopressor use and consideration of a vasopressor infusion during RSI to perhaps prevent cardiovascular collapse. And that's something we'll touch on, like I said, in an upcoming podcast. But can't thank you both enough for joining me on this podcast to review a very hot article that is online, not quite out in print, and something that's being hotly discussed currently in our social media settings. So my thanks to both of you. If anybody has any questions, please shoot us an email through the CCPEM website. We're so excited to be corresponding and interacting with so many of you who are listening to these podcasts. So if it's not even in relation to this one, please shoot us any topics that you'd like to hear on an upcoming podcast. I think that's going to do it for us on this particular podcast. We're just at about the end of our time here. My thanks for listening. Once again, this is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. Looking forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.